Hi, and welcome to the Lakeshore Update. I'm Dee Dotson. On this edition of the podcast, you'll hear the latest on the arrest of Gary Council President Ron Brewer Jr., confidential records of Dr. Ulrich Klopfer patients have been found, Jill Sheridan reports on possible ways to end the HIV epidemic, and Chris Nolte has a conversation with UCLA Jazz and Orchestra Professor Charlie Harrison, along with Miraville High School Orchestra Instructor Diane Rosenthal. All of that and more on this edition of Lakeshore Update. Gary Council President Ron Brewer Jr. is out of jail. Brewer, 44, was released Tuesday from the East Chicago jail after a 48-hour hold as the East Chicago Police Department continues its investigation into an accident in which Brewer was allegedly involved. Police in East Chicago arrested Brewer on allegations he fired a gun at two teenagers he suspected of stealing his car and then taking one of them back to Gary. Scott King, attorney for Ron Brewer, says his actions were a legal citizen's arrest. East Chicago Police Lieutenant Jose Rivera tells the Times that Brewer was arrested Sunday night on probable cause for criminal recklessness and kidnapping. Rivera says Brewer apparently tracked his stolen vehicle to East Chicago with a phone app and fired shots during a confrontation with the teenagers inside it. Rivera goes on to say Brewer wrongly took the law into his own hands without contacting the police.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
An Illinois man is expected to plead guilty in an Indiana shootout that killed one of his associates and wounded a federal agent. Court records show 26-year-old Bernard Graham of Calumet City has acknowledged firing a gun during a June 2018 robbery of two undercover ATF agents who were investigating illicit gun purchases in Gary. The Times reports Graham's plea agreement calls for him to plead guilty to armed assault and discharge of a firearm. An ATF agent was wounded and one of Graham's partners died. A guilty plea would allow him to avoid a jury trial and a possible life sentence. A change of plea hearing is tentatively scheduled for Monday. Another suspect pleaded guilty last month in the shootout.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Indiana's Attorney General says thousands of patient medical records have been found at three shuttered Indiana abortion clinics that were operated by a late abortion doctor whose Illinois garage was found to contain more than 2,200 sets of preserved fetal remains. Attorney General Curtis Hill said that the women who were patients at Dr. Ulrich Klopfer's clinics in Gary, South Bend, and Fort Wayne had an expectation that their privacy would be protected, but their records were, quote, abandoned in the clinics when they closed years ago. Investigators searched the buildings and other properties last Thursday. A.G. Hill says no additional sets of fetal remains were found. He says preliminary findings indicate that all 2,246 sets of fetal remains found earlier this month in the garage at Klopfer's Will County home came from his former Indiana clinics.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Three Northwest Indiana counties have earned a long-sought federal designation that's expected to open the door for funding to spur economic development. Officials say the U.S. Department of Commerce has declared Lake, Porter, and LaPorte counties as an economic development district. That designation is expected to open up the region that's part of the Chicago metropolitan area to federal funding for economic development planning and projects. The Times reports the Northwestern Indiana Regional Planning Commission had pursued the federal designation for more than a decade. Commission Chairwoman Diane Knoll says that many people, quote, contributed many years of effort to achieve this designation. She and the commission's other members will now serve as the board members for the new economic development district.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Teachers of color feel undervalued and less visible in their schools compared to white peers, according to a new report. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jenny Lindsay has more on some of the challenges to diversify the teaching workforce and what experts say would help.
The Teach Plus report lists more challenges, like the financial cost to teach and a lack of cultural awareness in schools. And Director of Research Mark Teo says schools and states should find solutions by listening to teachers. He says that can happen with data collected by exit interviews and surveys, but it shouldn't stop there.
But then you can also do things like hold teacher cabinets or conduct less formal kinds of research to hear from classroom teachers on what their experiences are.
Teo says some solutions are more resource-dependent than others. The report also recommends offering financial incentives to support teachers from Black and Latinx communities as they support students. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A new report examines possible ways to end the HIV epidemic. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that one Indiana county is included in the national analysis.
In 2015, Scott County experienced an HIV outbreak fueled by the injection of opioids. Since then, the county has been able to reduce the number of new cases. The Bipartisan Policy Center put out the Ending HIV in America report. Chief Medical Advisor Anand Parekh says Scott County achieved this through a coordinated response.
Offering routine testing, running a needle exchange program, you know, prescribing medicines for the prevention of HIV, and working with primary care providers.
Indiana's expansion of Medicaid was also highlighted as a policy that helped address the outbreak. More than 12,500 people in Indiana are living with HIV. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A new statewide campaign to address sexual assault against women in Indiana launched Wednesday. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports a coalition will work to raise awareness and change laws around the issue.
One in five women in Indiana report having been sexually assaulted. The new campaign will use cultural efforts, including readings and exhibits, to drive change at the State House. Tracy Horth Kruger is president of the Indiana Coalition to End Sexual Assault. She says a project called El Tendedaro, or the Clothesline, displays handwritten notes of victim stories.
These come from victims, and victim stories are so powerful to read and to think about and ponder, and it's going to help shape laws.
Numerous events to raise awareness around the issue are planned throughout 2020. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
A new lawsuit is challenging Indiana's work requirements for the state's Medicaid expansion program, HIP. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports this is the fourth federal lawsuit to stop these provisions.
Medicaid work requirements have been struck down in three other states. Indiana's Gateway to Work program launched at the beginning of this year, and people had to start reporting work, school, or volunteer hours in July. The National Health Law Program and Indiana Legal Services, or ILS, filed the suit. Director of Advocacy at ILS, Adam Mueller, says the complaint includes four Hoosiers on HIP.
We are hoping to help these folks now before it becomes a problem, before they could face a potential suspension in coverage.
HIP members will be required to report 80 hours a month by January 2020. There are a number of exemptions, including caregivers or medically frail individuals. In a written statement, Indiana Governor Eric Holcomb says Indiana's program is different. He says it includes, quote, supports and pathways to ensure Hoosiers can easily skill up, volunteer in their community, or get a better paying job. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Attorney General Curtis Hill wants a federal court to rehear his appeal of a decision that halted enforcement of a 2017 anti-abortion bill. If a girl under age 18 in Indiana doesn't or can't get consent for an abortion from her parents, she can go to court to bypass that requirement. A 2017 state law signed by Governor Eric Holcomb said a judge will decide if the parents are informed of that hearing. Opponents of the measure argued it would scare off girls from even trying to get an abortion. And both a federal judge in Indianapolis and a three-judge panel at the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals agreed, temporarily stopping the law from taking effect. Curtis Hill now wants the full 11-judge appeals court to hear the case. There's no timetable for when the court will decide whether to agree to Hill's request.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
As the school year begins, parents are checking off things they need to do, including making sure their children get required vaccines. But some parents have opted out, which has led to the worst measles outbreak the U.S. has seen in more than 20 years. Now, doctors and nurses are working to get more children vaccinated. Steph White said of Side Effects Public Media has more from Southern Illinois.
So she is going to get three. She'll get the VTAP.
Nurse Tracy Thomas is explaining the vaccine schedule to Jemira Crook at the Jackson County Health Department. Crook has brought her two children in to get their shots before school starts. The girls have been playing quietly, unaware of why they're here. They're among the families trying to beat the state's deadline for immunizations against measles and other diseases. Thomas says the department has seen a rush recently.
There is an October 15th deadline that they should have their vaccinations. Otherwise, they would have to get a religious exemption from their physicians.
Only five states in the U.S. ban non-medical exemptions for vaccines. The rest allow parents to opt out for personal or religious reasons. I ask Crook if she worries about parents who don't vaccinate their kids.
Yeah, I guess so, because then they could cause my kids to get sick, so yeah.
Her five-year-old daughter Chloe has other worries. She's thinking about having to get stuck with a needle, despite all efforts to distract her.
Don't watch me, hey! It's scary. 1, 2, 3, done!
Parents who opt out of vaccines are generally basing their fears on a debunked study from 1998 and anecdotes of vaccine injuries, which rarely occur. Thompson says the staff at the health department do their best to let parents know vaccines are safe.
Try to tell them, you know, reassure them that we've given lots of shots, haven't seen any bad things, give them the vaccine information statements.
Dr. Jeff Ripperda is a primary care physician in Jackson County, not far from the health department. He says that people who refuse vaccines are rare, but he sees a lot of people who have concerns.
It's a fairly regular occurrence in my practice, and I presume this is true for most physicians who do primary care or pediatrics, to meet parents who are skittish about vaccinating their kids.
When enough people don't vaccinate, an entire community is put at risk for an epidemic. Dr. LJ Tan of the Immunization Action Coalition calls it community immunity.
And so what happens when you vaccinate is that you take out a certain percentage of the population from actually being able to get infected. So when one person gets sick and then they contact two people, but if both those people have been vaccinated, the infection stops.
Tan says that with a highly infectious disease like measles, communities need at least a 90% vaccination rate to be protected. But some entire states are below that threshold. Even when the state rates are sufficient, individual schools may not be. And that makes it easier for illnesses to spread to people who can't be vaccinated. They might be undergoing chemotherapy or be on steroids for asthma, or they might be too young for certain vaccines.
We live in a community with standards that we respect and protect the vulnerable in our communities.
Some states, like Illinois, make vaccine data publicly available, allowing parents to see where their school district falls. If school rates are low, Tan says parents can pressure the administration or other parents to try to raise them. Dr. Ripperda handles reluctant families a different way. He's found that facts may not sway people, but stories do. He recalls one patient who, at 29 years old, nearly died from the flu.
He had a complication to the flu, and I actually had him on a ventilator in the ICU, and I called his young wife in. He had two young children at the time, and said, I don't think he's going to make it. If you have any family who wants to come and see him before he passes, I think you need to make that happen right now.
The man survived, but he was hospitalized for almost 2 months and needed extra oxygen for a year and a half. When all else fails, Ripperda stays firm. If parents don't want to vaccinate, they need to find a new doctor.
And if somebody wants to come and see me, but they're not going to permit me to do what I think is the single most beneficial thing that I can do for their kids, then what's the point of having a relationship with me?
Steph Whiteside for Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Lakeshore Update with Dee Dotson.
Here's regionally speaking host Chris Nolte with a conversation with Charlie Harrison and Diane Rosenthal.
Charlie Harrison is a UCLA jazz professor and a former associate director of the Jazz Orchestra in Chicago. And the Chicago group is one of the top performing groups in the world. He came down to Northwest Indiana earlier this week and spent a day with Maryville High School orchestra teacher Diane Rosenthal and her students. Rosenthal commissioned a piece from Harrison specifically for the After School Jazz Orchestra Club for its 2020 Indiana State School Music Association performances. And she talked with us about how she knows Charlie, about his career in music, and the thoughts behind what is called the Pirate Suite.
Well, the way this came about, Charlie and I went to high school together and were musicians together in high school and reconnected at a high school reunion a couple years back. And you do the usual high school reunion thing. Oh, what are you doing? You married? You got kids? What's your job? Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, and I said, oh, I teach high school orchestra. And he said, I'm a jazz composition professor at UCLA. Okay, so we started chatting, and I had just that year started a jazz club here. I'm a classically trained musician, and so I was a little out of my element, and I thought, well, here's a great resource. So we started chatting, and after about a year or so, I got to the point of saying, hey, do you do commissions? He's a composer, arranger. Would you be willing to write a piece for my jazz club? It's difficult to find music, jazz music written specifically for string instruments, violin, viola, cello, bass. And so he was gracious enough to do that, and we communicated over the next, I would say, 6 months or so getting that done. And then he's been fantastic. He's been in each of my classes all day long. Kids have been asking great questions, and he's been giving them some feedback on their playing.
Tell us a little bit about the piece, and I'll ask him in more detail, too, about the piece that you had him commissioned to do.
The Jazz Orchestra participates in the Indiana State School Music Association Jazz Contest in March, and the requirements of the contest are that the set you play, the pieces you choose to play for the judges, have to show a variety of styles. I can't go and have the kids play all Duke Ellington swing. They have to show that they have flexibility, that they can play ballads, that they can play Latin jazz or any different option, but you can't go in playing all the same.
Yep.
So Charlie and I started talking about the idea of a suite that would take care of that right off the bat. Instead of me trying to find a swing piece and a blues piece, and you know, he would take care of that for us. The Pirate Suite then covers the first movement is swing, the second movement is a ballad, and the third movement is blues. And he did communicate with me about the kids' ability level and range and what they'd like to play, what they need to play to learn. And he wrote something that's tailor-made for them. That's an unusual thing.
Now, have they had a chance to do any rehearsals on this piece yet, or will they be learning that in time?
Just a little. I wish we'd been able to do more, but his event that he was coming to Chicago for was in September, and as you know, we've only been in school about 6 weeks, and we have a concert in 2 weeks of all different music, classical music, that we need to be working on. So we've had only two meetings of the jazz club itself after school, last Monday and the previous Monday. We did a little bit of work on it in my most advanced class. Some of the kids overlap into jazz, so I'd have at least a few ringers who had a fair amount of instruction, but Charlie's been very gracious. He understands these are high school kids. We haven't had a huge amount of time on the pieces, but they generally know them, can play them, and I'm hoping that he's going to give them a lot more of the jazz vocabulary and the feel for it that as a classical musician I don't maybe have instinctively to give to them.
Before we bring you our conversation, let's hear a little of Charlie Harrison's work as the conductor of the UCLA Jazz Orchestra. And then he'll tell us more about being with the Maryville High School Jazz Club members and about the special music that he's created for them.
Exciting to see so many really high quality high school jazz programs around, and really to expand on that, working with the Maryville High School Jazz Club, basically being a jazz string orchestra, is really to me eye opening and exciting to see that jazz is now moving beyond just the, I guess, the limitations or the confines that we have put on it, previously, meaning mm-hmm. that it had to be either a small combo or just a traditional big band. For me, working on the project and then seeing the kids being so excited about playing jazz as string players is really thrilling for me.
This yeah. Pirate Suite, as it's called, gives the students an opportunity to get the experience within the training that they have with being a string jazz orchestra of putting together, I guess, an opportunity to learn something that maybe a big band would normally get to do. Did you kind of take some of the ideas from what, for example, Duke Ellington had done with his own suites that he had composed for his band in the past?
Perhaps. I guess we could look at it that way. I don't really say that I was approaching, say, Duke Ellington or Billy Strayhorn would have in their extended suites. I know that they later in Duke Ellington's career, he composed quite a few. And those usually a common inspiration, whether it was one of his suites was the New Orleans suite, and he had written a Latin American suite and a Far East suite, and those usually had some kind of common experience that then led to the inspiration for the music. In this case, or at least in the case of the Pirate Suite, I was really, I think, more motivated by the fact that I was writing for an ensemble that was not the traditional jazz ensemble.
Right.
This is a string group. And by the token that it's a string group, most of the musicians are not seasoned jazz musicians. So what I wanted to do was kind of provide a variety of styles that would expose them to, in some ways, to traditional jazz forms and traditional jazz stylings, but also, in the case of one of the movements, kind of give them a taste of a little bit more modern, at least a more modern harmonic approach, and maybe even a little bit more of a modern approach in terms of the form of the piece. Now, mm-hmm. now two of the movements, the first movement and the last movement, are the ones that I consider to be a little more traditional, and the second movement is the one that's, I think, a little different.
Do you think that the students are really going to enjoy working on this piece, perfecting it and learning it and actually getting to perform it?
I sure hope so. I've enjoyed working with the students, really. Now, we haven't truly worked on the Pirate Suite yet, but I've met quite a few of the students who will be playing in that ensemble, and
mm-hmm.
they seem to be pretty excited about it so far. They've asked me a lot of questions about it, and I'm really thrilled to be here and have a chance to work with them.
This, by the way, is the third year for the Jazz Orchestra Club that Diane Rosenthal had started at Maryville High School.
Regionally Speaking with host Chris Nolte can be heard each Monday through Thursday at noon on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM and streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org, where you can also find podcasts of the show when you click on the program link. For the latest in local news and information, tune in Monday at 6 a.m. for Morning Edition with local host
Chris Nolte. Lakeshore Update is supported by the listeners and members of Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Podcasts for Lakeshore Update are posted each Friday on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Make sure you search for WLPR and select us as your home station. Music for Lakeshore Update was written and produced by BenSound.com. For Lakeshore Update, I'm Dee Dotson.